This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 2, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Amma Nsiabwadi, sitting in for Deepa Fernandez, who is on assignment in Haiti. Bush's 2005 budget proposal. More on the ground reports from Haiti. And denials over Aristide's kidnapping. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Two attacks on Shiite shrines today killed at least 140 people and wounded hundreds more in Iraq. Multiple mortar blasts in Karbala and Baghdad ripped through the religious pilgrims and other believers on this special day of worship. Suspicions of who is to blame range from the United States and Israel to a Jordanian militant. The U.S.-installed Iraqi Interim Governing Council declared 3 days of mourning. And the streets of Port-au-Prince are just now being picked up as the people of Haiti try to restore law and order to the nation. In Port-au-Prince, Silvio Joost reports.
Guy Phillips, leader of the rebel group, in a press conference says he has no political ambitions and that he is willing to cooperate with international forces to provide security. At present, the total number of international forces consisting of U.S., Canadian, and French troops is not available. Though there are over 300 U.S. troops in Haiti, more will be arriving here during the course of the day and week. The international airport, which is set to be opening soon, is under the multinational forces' control. There is no time limit set on the duration of their mission. While all of this is going on, Haitian citizens are trying to put the pieces of their lives back together again. They are out on the streets evaluating the level of devastation and looking for places to buy food and provisions. Schools remain closed. The attitude amongst many people concerning the presence of international forces is watch and see. Foreign nationals in Haiti are still being evacuated. In provincial towns, reports of retaliation from OPs supported the ex-president are circulating. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Silvio Juice, Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
We'll have more from Haiti coming up. Demonstrators will gather in opposition to the Bush administration's intervention in Haiti. Leanne Caldwell reports from WBAI in New York.
Outside the United Nations headquarters, protesters gathered to denounce the progression of events occurring in Haiti over the past several weeks. Protest organizers believe the United States government destroyed the democratic process in Haiti by rousing opposition leaders, and they back reports that the Bush administration forced Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide out of the country. Colette Ping from the December 12th movement.
Voice our dissent with the current situation and request that President Aristide be brought to the United Nations and speak and address the world body, and because as an elected leader in a democracy, it's important that in the international forum there be some discourse as opposed to the rule of force, what is dictating what happens.
Ping also said that Aristide should have completed his term that would end in 2005. A consistent democratic law is the only way to produce a stable Haiti, she said. For Free Speech Radio News in New York, I am Leanne Caldwell.
The U.S. Supreme Court issued a statement saying Justice Antonin Scalia should decide whether to recuse himself from the Sierra Club's case against Vice President Cheney and for full disclosure of Energy Task Force meeting notes. Jay Tamboli reports from D.C.
The Sierra Club charges Cheney as illegally keeping notes and agendas from the committee meetings that ultimately created the nation's energy policy. The Supreme Court will hear the Sierra Club's suit to force Cheney to release the documents in April or May. The Sierra Club wants Justice Scalia to recuse himself from the case because Justice Scalia took a personal vacation with the vice president in early February at Cheney's expense. David Bookbinder, legal director of the Sierra Club, stated that Scalia's dealings with Vice President Cheney were improper.
This has created in the public mind an appearance of impropriety that a judge would be going on vacation with one of the parties in the case.
Scalia denies any wrongdoing in socializing with Cheney. The court's written decision says it is up to Scalia to decide whether hearing the case is unethical. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Jay Tamboli.
Nigerian bank officials are threatening to fire 20,000 workers, hoping to curb a plan by the country's main workers' union to picket them. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
Nigeria's main workers' union says bank workers are denied the right to form unions, while many bank workers are employed on casual basis. President of the workers' union has given the banks 48 hours to respect the rights of their workers or be shut down. 18 banks have chosen to negotiate with the workers' union, but 40 other banks have jointly decided to sack their casual workers if the labor union attempts to force them to regularize their employment. The struggle has seen angry workers shut down many large corporations. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the Department of Homeland Security is 1 year old. President Bush said the department deserves a gold star for a job well done, but he warned that so-called terrorists are still lurking in the dark to kill Americans. However, a new critical report on Bush's 2005 budget suggests that the president's multi-billion dollar proposal for the military does little to increase safety for U.S. citizens from an attack, while it funds old programs meant to fight the Cold War. Mitch Jeserich reports.
President George Bush, along with Secretary of Department of Homeland Security Tom Ridge, addressed a crowd of first responders in Washington, D.C. to commemorate the one-year anniversary of Homeland Security Department.
We're disrupting terrorist operations. We're cutting off their funding. We're chasing down their leaders one person at a time. We are relentless. We are strong. We refused to yield.
However, a report released this week by the think tank Foreign Policy and Focus suggests by looking at the president's 2005 budget proposal, Bush is far more interested in offense than defense. The report indicates that despite administration promises to fight terrorism through a comprehensive approach, its budget puts seven times as many resources into the military than non-military security, including the Department of Homeland Security. Miriam Pemberton with the Foreign Policy and Focus says much of the military budget is spent on projects meant to fight the old Soviet Union.
One of the most egregious, I would say, is the F-22 Raptor aircraft. This is a stealth aircraft program. You know, no terrorist organization has any fighters of any kind. No terrorist organization has any anti-aircraft radar systems. And so this, you know, hugely expensive aircraft program really has no relevance to the war on terrorism. So,
who's building that aircraft?
Well, it's a consortium, but Lockheed Martin is the lead contractor.
Another Bush administration strategy to increase global security is through free trade and open market capitalism. President Bush is proposing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to build and run the largest U.S. embassy in the world, located right in Baghdad. This will likely help serve the administration's desire to open up the Iraqi economy to free market forces well before a democratic government is elected to weigh in on such a transformation. The coalition has already transformed Iraq's banking system as J.P. Morgan and Chase, known for supporting non-democratic governments like Qatar and former apartheid regime in South Africa, is heading a consortium of international banks to develop Iraq's banking system. The State Department also announced that it is making economic inroads with other Middle Eastern and North African countries. On Tuesday, Assistant Secretary William Burns told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the U.S. is close to striking a free trade deal with Morocco.
King Mohammed and his government have launched what is, in our judgment, a very serious and very courageous program of reform. And so as we look at Morocco, it's very much in the American interest to invest in the success of those reform programs.
Human rights activists have for some time criticized the U.S.'s willingness to economically participate with countries known for human rights violations. Morocco has such a shady past, but in 1999, it began compensating victims who were abducted and their families between the 1960s and the 1990s. However, hundreds of cases concerning people known as Sahrawis from the Western Sahara remain unclear. Also, over 30 political prisoners remain in detention, and several journalists are facing prison sentences for criticizing the government. Krista Ridley is with Amnesty International.
Any relationship with the government, and including the government of Morocco, the U.S. government should be weighing the issues of human rights and ensuring that human rights are protected and promoted. And with Morocco, as they debate the issue or as they decide to have closer trade ties, they should also be bringing up the issues of concern in the human rights arena and really pressuring the Moroccan government, both publicly and privately, to improve their human rights record.
I'm Mitch Jeserich for Free Speech Radio News.
The AP reports that exiled ex-Haitian leader Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier told a television reporter he wants to return to his homeland now that Jean-Bertrand Aristide is out of the country. Duvalier told a reporter during an interview in Paris that, quote, "I'm ready to put myself at the disposal of the Haitian people." He said, however, he did not plan to run for president. Meanwhile, one city in Haiti with relative calm is the northern port city of Cape Haitien. The city has no official curfew, yet streets are empty by 7 p.m. Banks and schools remain closed, but street markets and small stores today resumed business. The new police force has begun a campaign to round up Aristide supporters, many of whom have fled into nearby mountains. Those already captured are housed in the old port warehouse. FSRN's Deepa Fernandez and Cody Emmanuel met with the new police chief and some prisoners this morning, and they bring us this report from Cape Haitien.
It's 10 a.m. and the former customs port of entry for ships to Cape Haitien is crowded as people wait outside the shut gates. This is the new police headquarters. The old one was burned down after anti-Aristide forces took Cape Haitien over a week ago. Inside, many people mill around with weapons strapped to them. A large, crumbling tin warehouse, which used to store goods from incoming cargo ships, now holds human beings. Prisoners captured in the time after Cape Haitien fell to armed gangs. The armed gangs now run the city and the new police force. We meet with Commander Pierre Willen. He essentially runs Cape Haitien. Some describe him as the number two to Guy Philippe. He openly told us that his main goal was to find and punish those associated with Chimé, the pro-Aristide armed gangs that are accused of burning houses and businesses.
En premier lieu, ma porte un message ba yo kap tande si na passe sur les ondes.
I call upon the Chimere who are hiding in the mountains, wherever you are, give up your arms immediately. If you don't, that will tell us that you are engaged in the continued struggle to support Lavalas. Therefore, if you want to avoid retaliation between us, the army, and you, the armed civilians, I suggest you give up your weapons immediately. When we come after you, it will be with all our might. You can run, but remember, you have wives, children, brothers, sisters, and even neighbors. They could be victims. To avoid a bloodbath with the armed forces, give up your arms. We are here and we are not going anywhere. President Aristide removed the Haitian army and replaced it with the Chimere. As of 1984 to today, the Haitian military have regrouped in force, accompanied by the police force that was to provide security. But the police force was negligent and they gave their arms to the Chimere, who now cause trouble. We are now providing security. We love our country, we love our people, because we are all Haitians.
That was Commander Pierre Willen, who is running the police force and essentially the city of Cape Haitien. It's hard to find anyone in Cape Haitien who will openly say that they support the recently deposed President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The fear of reprisals is everywhere. Many people tell us openly that any armed Aristide supporters will be killed. Currently, in other towns, cemeteries have been turned into prison cells, mausoleums are opened, and suspected Chimere are locked inside. We were allowed to interview the main prisoner accused of being part of the Chimere gang, accused of burning down houses and businesses. We find him lying on a concrete floor on a dirty mattress in a boiler room with other prisoners. No one is handcuffed or shackled in any way, but they all seem very vacant, almost in a drugged state. One man is shaking uncontrollably. Louis, who many say will be killed very soon, is obviously trying to save his life when he talks to us.
Can you tell us how you are?
I'm okay. I'm fine. I was given a warm welcome. When someone is doing something bad, even if you are his own child, sometimes he has to give you a good beating to get you back on track. I don't have anything bad to say against the police. If someone says these guys are criminals, I don't see that. If it wasn't for him, I would have died. He stayed with me last night. He did something for me. Do you see this?
Prisoner Lewis points to his bruised and beaten arms.
Are you accused of being a Chimere?
Chimere? I don't know what you are talking about. I'm a technical director for the customs service here in Cape Haitien. I am an intellectual. How could I be a Chimere? I finished school at 19. I spent 2.5 years in customs school. From there, I spent 9 months in Cuba.
As we come out of his prison cell, a man tells us that Luis will very soon be killed. The fate of the other hundreds of prisoners also does not look good. From the police headquarters in Cape Haitien, I'm Deepa Fernandez with Cody Emmanuel.
International reports say that anti-government leader Guy Philippe declared himself Haiti's new military commander and called on the people to give his forces, quote, the mandate to provide them with security. And today, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan appealed for a long-term international commitment to Haiti, saying the effort to stabilize the country could take years. Meanwhile, Annan and other United Nations officials are refusing to comment on claims by Haiti's democratically elected president that he was kidnapped by US operatives and forced to resign. Susan Wood has more from the UN.
Eight members of the Congressional Black Caucus came to the United Nations on Tuesday to begin consultations on Haiti with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Afterwards, Congressmember Charles Rangel contradicted earlier statements by U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell that Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide had left the country willingly.
Unlike the reports that's coming out of the State Department, President Aristide feels that it was a coup, that he felt he was kidnapped, that he was told by United States authority that they could no longer protect his life, that for 20 hours he was placed on a plane taken to an unknown country, which turns out to be Central Africa.
Rangel said that in his conversations with Aristide, the Haitian president told him that he had been coerced into signing a letter of resignation.
He wanted to make it abundantly clear that the so-called resignation was dictated to him over the phone by representatives from the United States Embassy, who once again told him that they could no longer be responsible for his safety.
Members of the Black Caucus vowed that they would not let the matter die. Congressmember Barbara Lee said she would raise the issue on Wednesday at a meeting of the House International Relations Committee. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan today evaded reporters' questions on the subject, saying he had not been privy to the conversations between Washington and Aristide.
We should put the people of Haiti at the center of everything we try to do and try and help them build a better future. And as I have indicated before, I hope this time the international community will go in for the long haul and not a quick turnaround.
But Congressmember Donald Payne said if indeed there had been a coup, it would be irresponsible for the UN to deal with an illegal government coming to power in Haiti by force. I'm Susan Stone, reading for Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Senator John Kerry and Senator John Edwards, Democratic presidential hopefuls, rushed back to the Capitol this Super Tuesday to vote on the gun liability bill, which grants widespread immunity to the gun industry from lawsuits. However, for gun control advocates, some victories have been achieved through the passage of additional amendments. Selina Musuta reports from our Washington, D.C. Bureau.
The National Rifle Association and the gun industry are heading towards a major victory on Capitol Hill as the Senate is set to pass a measure that takes away the right of victims to sue gun manufacturers if they are injured by the gun industry's product. Eric Howard is with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence.
For the first time in American history, the Senate may choose to vote to give one industry an exemption from negligence, gross negligence, and liability law. And that industry that the Senate is choosing to give this special legal immunity to is the gun industry. There really aren't words for how shameful this action would be.
A majority of Senate Democrats are opposed to the bill. However, it does have some Democratic support, including Senator Minority Leader Tom Daschle. Several Democratic senators are trying to attach several amendments onto the bill. Senator Dianne Feinstein successfully passed an amendment to reauthorize the assault weapon ban that would have expired in September.
In the past few days, we've heard all kinds of horror stories about the gun industry planning to put bayonet mounts and grenade launchers and flash suppressors back on the market again, as well as the AK-47, the Uzi. And what could that have brought about? Anyone that's from a city knows what it could be brought about. Anyone who's a true hunter knows that you don't need these weapons and that we have exempted by specific name 670 weapons.
Another successful amendment sponsored by Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona will close the gun show loophole, which stops gun show sales without background checks. Another amendment that gun control advocates oppose would repeal the D.C. gun ban on handguns and semi-automatics. D.C. resident Maria Michaels, whose son was shot and killed, calls on Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee to pull the amendment.
I'm here to make my own personal plea to a major leader Bill Frist. The United States allows our city gun safety laws to stand. I come forth in the name of my son, Devin Folks, who was shot and killed as he left school, Anacostia High School, on October the 30th. I come forward in the name of my 15-year-old daughter, Artemita Folks, who attends Johnson Junior High in Southeast Washington. Artemita will soon be a student at Anacostia, where Devin was killed. Congress cannot bring Devin back, but Congress can help protect him, Artemita, and other children in the city.
Senator Bill Frist tabled the amendment before the vote on the final bill, and it is unclear whether he will bring it up later on. If the Senate passes the gun industry immunity measure, it will then go to a conference committee where the bill can still be changed. For Free Speech Radio News, along with Darby Hickey, I am Selena Masuta. Public policymakers met with citizen activists in Los Angeles to discuss Diebold's new electronic voting systems used in today's primary vote. FSRN's Jason Rosenkrantz reports from Los Angeles.
Can voters trust paperless electronic voting systems? And do the benefits of such systems outweigh concerns about their security? After meeting with voting rights activists in Los Angeles, LA County Registrar Connie McCormack said that much of the resistance to the electronic voting systems is motivated by fear.
The question of whether or not we should have a electronic system, I think a lot of it has to do with change. People have problems with change, and it's a kind of an unknown.
However, Kim Alexander, president of the California Voters Foundation, thought that resistance to the electronic voting systems was motivated less by fear than by a legitimate concern for democracy.
And I think there's no greater threat that we face to democracy right today, quite frankly, than this use of computerized paperless systems run on proprietary secret software.
The central issue, Alexander stressed, is the fact that the new systems lack any way for voters to verify that their vote is being recorded in the way they intend. But Registrar McCormack claimed that there was no evidence of problems with the new systems.
Where is the evidence?
Alexander countered that the lack of a verifiable audit means there is no way to prove the absence of fraud.
Those who defend paperless computerized voting systems believe the burden of proof is on critics to show the voting machines are not working. But I believe the burden of proof is on election officials to show that the voting machines are working. Indeed, this is what the idea of verification is all about. It's to demonstrate to the public that they can have confidence in election outcomes.
Cathay Feng, program director of the Voting Rights Unit at the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, is more concerned with the superior accessibility of the new electronic voting systems than with their potential for being manipulated.
Our communities for a long time have had a hard time trying to vote. So for us anyways, we want to see touchscreens because it really is quite user-friendly. And if there are machines out there that will improve accessibility because it makes it easier to vote, it makes it more inviting, that's what we want to try to bring people out, because a democracy doesn't work until you have 80%, 100% of the people participating as opposed to 30% or 50%.
Although California's Secretary of State, Kevin Shelley, has announced that he will require a voter-verified paper record of every digital ballot cast, this requirement will not take effect until July 2006, too late for both today's primary and November's general election. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jason Rosenkrantz in Los Angeles.
Tribal leaders on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation voted down an ordinance last week that would have approved a reservation-wide referendum vote for the legalization of alcohol. The legislation to permit the sale and consumption of alcohol on the Dry Ogallala Sioux Reservation was proposed in December 2000 by tribal council representatives as a road to economic development. FSRN correspondent Jim Kent visited the Pine Ridge Reservation to speak to tribal members on both sides of an issue that may not be a dead horse.
Alcohol has been a scourge to Native Americans since it was first introduced into their culture by Western Europeans. For the Ogallala Sioux, the topic is particularly sensitive. The non-native border town of White Clay, Nebraska, lies immediately next to the Pine Ridge Reservation and sells more than $4 million in beer each year, most to Ogallala Sioux tribal members. But when his constituents came forward asking about funding for a tribal correctional facility and detox center, Tribal Councilman Gary Janice saw an upside in the controversy over white clay.
I thought back in a little bit of when the alcohol issue was passed around back and forth from White Clay, trying to shut them down. Well, instead of trying to shut them down, why don't we on the reservation legalize it and take the revenues from that to supplement our health care, our education, our detox facility, just the everyday living for our people, electricity, propane, food, groceries, things of that nature.
Tribal Finance Committee Coordinator Eileen Janice sees a twofold benefit of legalizing alcohol on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
Nobody really can see the future, but I see there are more laws. I see a better court system coming out of it, and there's no jobs. This would bring jobs, even management positions. There's a lot of needs out there. And also there was a survey done where people would drink in moderation. If it was legalized on the reservation, they can sit at home in their yard. They wouldn't have to go anywhere or bring it by the casefuls and drink it all in one night, you know.
But many tribal members are wary of the benefits Janice touts in support of alcohol legalization, especially the promised management positions, which Janice says would actually be jobs managing liquor stores. Kevin Paniska is an Oglala Sioux tribal member who publishes Well Nations magazine, which centers on positive stories of health and wellness in the Native community. Paniska says the proposal to legalize alcohol is a reflection of the times.
How desperate are we as an Oglala Lakota Nation when the only other means of generating revenue to fund programs and to help people, the only other way that we can find to raise money for them is to sell alcohol and use the tax money to help our people?
Paniska isn't the only one who questions the morality of the proposal. Richard Ironcloud is part of the group Common Men Who Share Wisdom, which fought against the referendum vote to legalize alcohol on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Ironcloud says the primary problem isn't the tribal council's lack of money.
They need to take a look at how they spend their money. I think the history that we had, you know, with alcohol, I think that I don't think it's ever, you know, going to be the answer to our economic problems.
With more than 500 people protesting outside the tribe's administration building last Tuesday, the Oglala Sioux Tribal Council voted against holding a referendum vote to legalize alcohol. But Gary Janice says even with the proposal defeated, his district, the closest to the village of White Clay, will still pursue the idea.
We have three representatives out of Pine Ridge District. We've got to do what the people of Pine Ridge want us to do, our district. So we're going to find a way to legalize it, and the money will stay with Pine Ridge District.
Alcohol sales and consumption were permitted on the Pine Ridge Reservation from 1964 to 1970, but a 1983 reservation-wide referendum vote overwhelmingly opposed the legislation and turned Pine Ridge into a dry reservation, as it remains. Whether or not one reservation district will be permitted to legalize what tribal substance abuse workers have called the number one health, accident, and injury problem on the reservation remains to be seen.
By law, that's legal, that's binding.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Amma Bouadi.